everywhere I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long way to go.
Retro Gaming Radio 2011. Keep it retro.
Hello, folks, and welcome to the September 2012 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. I'm Shane R. Monroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, we knew we were going to be a little late this month. I'm sorry about that, but sometimes real life does get in the way. Very busy, but hopefully you will feel this show was indeed worth it. This month we're going to have an editorial commentary on how does tech evolve when sky is the limit. And we're going to be looking at another anniversary, 20 years of my very own software production company, Dark Unicorn Productions. Believe me, I can make this interesting. I spent a lot of time researching this. Hopefully you guys will find it as interesting to relive it as I did. Of course, we'll have our regular Bits and Bytes segment, reviews, and so much more right here on this edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This month's editorial commentary, how does tech evolve when the sky is the limit? I was thinking about this the other day, and I thought it'd be an interesting topic to discuss here, because a lot of classic gaming, retro gaming, was a pivotal point in technology history, and also one of the main driving forces of technology. Well, that and pornography, of course. Porn and video gaming or entertainment definitely pushes technology. Well, let's talk about the chase of technology. It all started in the arcades, right? You had Space Invaders, Pac-Man, you had pinball, you had arcades that had technology that you wanted to play at home. Well, the consoles, like the Atari 2600, the ColecoVision, the Intellivision, all chased the arcades. The arcades would be where the newest, greatest, baddest technology would come out. And then the next thing you know, a new console would come out, or the consoles would vie for the best possible version of the arcade game. And that's what really drove some of these game consoles, right? You had the Atari 2600 that, let's be honest, none of the, quote, arcade translations were all that good of translations. Sure, there were a few of them that worked out. I mean, who could argue that Space Invaders wasn't good or Asteroids? It was amazing that the Atari 2600 was able to do anything even close. But then you had the Intellivision. They got a little bit closer, but they didn't have the licenses, so you got games that kind of looked like arcade games, but they weren't the arcade games. Every now and then you'd get something in there. But most of the time, it was pretty much an original product designed to look like an arcade game. And of course, what really set the bar was the ColecoVision. The ColecoVision came with a pack-in of Donkey Kong. Now, if you were to look at it now, you'd say, well, that's not even close to the arcade game. But back then, it was absolutely positively the closest Donkey Kong you could get. So the arcades pushed the home console market. Shortly thereafter, computers started coming into vogue. Now, we all know about the computer crash in the early 80s, 83, 84. Console games came crashing to the ground. Quickly, computers, the Commodore 64, the VIC-20, all of the 8-bit classics that we grew up with, slid into the scene, and they started pumping out games. Well, then the PCs started chasing the arcades, right? Because the arcades stuck around. Just because the consoles crashed definitely did not mean the arcades took a plunge, too. Of course, they were greatly diminished, but they weren't gone. As we started chasing megabits first, then megabytes, as we move forward, computers started chasing their own tail. More, better, greater sound, better graphics. And of course, there was still the arcade in the background, but the arcade had to kind of change things up. They had to take a different approach in the arcade. Eventually, arcades became an experience you could not get at home. They started making wild customized cabinets, things that there was simply no way to simulate at home, cockpit games, environmental cabinets, these sort of things. So the PCs couldn't quite catch up with that, right? Not only because they didn't have the power under the hood, but they also didn't have the extras. They didn't have the ability to just throw a cabinet together out of whatever they wanted and drill as many holes as they wanted for buttons, or add a VR helmet, or add a pistol or a light gun or some faction of add-ons, something that really added value, something that would drive you back to the arcade. So inevitably, computers took a different route. Instead of chasing the arcades, which eventually also turned redemption, they decided to chase TV and film. Thus became the push for realistic graphics. Up until a certain period of time, people were satisfied that we were getting incremental updates in terms of graphics. Nintendo, Super Nintendo. Then the 3D wave came out, right? Then all of a sudden, we had 3D gaming, and the whole thing reset. Isn't it amazing how that works? Every time there's a turning point in technology, we go back, right? Because let's be honest, if you took a look at a fantastically gorgeous Super Nintendo game, if you look at a Sega Saturn game, if you looked at that generation of top-notch 2D consoles, right? If you looked at those, they were gorgeous. They finally started getting these high-resolution graphics. They were all hand-drawn. They looked beautiful. They had, you know, they had gone through the generational gap with that console. They've learned how to tap every possible ounce out of it. And then along came the PlayStation 1 and the N64, and we were back to essentially playing games with 3D primitives, for lack of a better term. I mean, go back. I mean, I know for some of you, it's a huge nostalgia thing to look at the PS1 and the N64 and those rose-colored glasses, much like the rest of us, give us that nostalgic look. But go back. Those are some ugly games. They went from beautiful 2D to ugly 3D. So we started chasing television next. Television, video, movies. Instead of going the full motion video route, which we did try, and the people didn't like it, instead of going that direction, they instead decided to continue pushing the 3D technology, hoping that eventually we would get to a point to where what we played on the screen looked like what we saw on TV and the movies. And Toy Story was kind of that first kind of CG movie that said, oh, someday, that was the goal. That was where the bar was set. Someday, we will play games that look exactly like Toy Story. We're still not there yet. And how long has that been? I didn't write down the number for when Toy Story came out. But we're not there yet. And of course, everything chases porn, right? Pornography is the number one driver of technology. And here's the funny part about porn. Look at how we chased porn. Let's take a complete segue here. Let's go back to looking at pornography, right? We started with magazines and stag films, right? That's what porn really was. Then came the entertainment revolution. Then came the 2600, right? Most of you know that several adult video games were released on the VCS. They were games that involved various self-sexual satisfaction and many other things, but the point is it didn't, you couldn't be offended by these things. I mean, they were giant pixely blocks. They didn't even look like a penis or breasts. They looked like orange blocks. So nobody got offended, and of course, nobody really got into it, but they didn't stop. Porn continued to evolve. When the 8-bit computers came out, strip poker, I'll tell you what, I was an adolescent boy with my Commodore 64, and strip poker and me, we were close personal friends. And on the Commodore 64, it wasn't hand-drawn graphics. It was one of the earliest examples of digitized porn. Now, it was grayscale and low resolution. So it's much like, imagine taking a really old newspaper, blowing that up to like 160 by 120, and that's essentially what the naked girls looked like. Barely pornography, right? Well, as computers went forward, the drive was to get better porn. That means 16 color porn. Well, that was kind of bad. Then all of a sudden we had VGA. You know, oh, we have 256 color porn. Now we have the GIF revolution. Now we have JPEGs. Really, if you think about it, if you were to look back and look at MPEG and JPEG and GIF, all of the early file formats, what do you think they were really there for? They were there to promote porn. Now, the best part is we got to, as gamers, benefit from that. There were more chases going on, though, too, right? Handhelds started chasing consoles. And in some cases, they caught up, but it turned out that's not what anybody wanted. Right? Let's go back. What were the main handhelds of choice, right? The Game Boy, the original black and white, green screen, smearing graphics, scrolling, nasty Game Boy. One of the most popular handhelds in history, right? But these games chased the consoles, right? We had Super Mario Brothers on the NES. But now we wanted it on the handheld, right? So the franchises started trying to move to the handheld, and the handheld started running to catch up. Well, fortunately, Nintendo kind of knew better. They figured out that handheld wasn't about chasing graphics or chasing technology. They chased the games. They chased the software. They chased whatever it took to make the experience new. Or fresh, or bring something new to the table. They called it disruption. Take whatever the norm is and bust it. Move on with something else that your competitors don't see coming and or can't duplicate readily. So handhelds, in some respects, right? Look at the Atari Lynx. Look at the Sega Game Gear. Look at the Sega Nomad. In some cases, like the Nomad, they played the same damn games as the console. Look at the TurboGrafx-16 and the TurboGrafx-16 Express. Played the same games. The ultimate goal for handhelds was to be as much like their consoles as possible. And the biggest thing about consoles was to be as close to the arcade games as possible. Everybody was chasing everything. And now, we've got phones chasing everything. They're chasing handhelds. They're chasing PCs. We have laptops. Laptops, what's the story with laptops? They chased PCs. When can we have a laptop that's just as powerful as our desktop? Tablets are the same thing. They're chasing everything, too. They're chasing video games. They're chasing phones. They're chasing computers. So the real question is, if you think about it, we have pushed so hard to move forward in technology. We have pushed so hard to get high definition video in the palm of your hand. I can play Dragon's Lair on my phone. If you were to tell me back in the mid 80s, someday, you see that game in the arcade you just shoved $25 into? Someday you'll be playing that on a phone, not just the phone, but a phone. Who'd have thought that, right? That we'd have a phone we could stick in our pocket. This is Star Trek stuff. This is the communicator. This is all science fiction back then, right? You're going to have a phone that you can stick in your pocket. And on that phone, not only will we be able to make phone calls, but communicate with each other instantly. And you're going to be able to play Dragon's Lair on it. You're going to be able to play your Commodore 64 that you got at home, that big monster that's sucking up all your desk space, that's going to be in the palm of your hand at some point. Who'd have believed that? So the biggest problem that's facing our entertainment medium of choice, gaming, and let's be honest, every other technological market currently, right now, is what's to chase. How do you push technology forward? What is left to accomplish? Now, see, in the old days, we were able to do this incrementally. We had one market that would dictate the other market. The arcade came first. That's where the $15,000 machine would sit there, and somebody would try to bring it to the home computer or the home console. Then somebody would try to get it from the console down to the handheld, etc., etc., right? Now we've got the same sort of chase going on. But there's nothing setting the bar high anymore. There's nothing to chase. So what is there? What's left? Things we can't accomplish, at least yet. What's the next big thing? Think about it. What's the next big thing? What's the next big gaming opportunity that we're going to have? We've got motion control. We got cameras that can watch us and see what we're doing, that can apparently read our facial expressions coming up. We've got that. Okay, better graphics. But how much better? I mean, they look pretty good now, right? You know what I'm saying? So, what are we chasing? What's setting the bar for technology to chase? Really, nobody. Nothing. Even Nintendo, and you know, they kind of they re-kickstarted the market with the motion control, right? Sony copied them, Microsoft copied them. Boom, boom, boom. We can argue all day long whether Microsoft's Kinect is better than the Wii controller, blah. It doesn't matter. What really set the bar up again was Nintendo, and they were chased. Right? So now we have the Kinect. Nobody's really chasing that, but the Kinect is chasing itself. What are we chasing? Of course. What everybody's been waiting for the last, what, umpteenth years? The holodeck. That's what's left. Three-dimensional, holographic, realistic environments. AKA the holodeck on Star Trek. What else is there? You know what Microsoft is doing right now? They're taking a projector and putting Ms. Pac-Man on the walls of your living room. That's what they're chasing. They're chasing a way to project stuff on the walls. That's what Microsoft's doing. Nintendo, they're trying to utilize their dual screen technology to put a nice big fat screen in your hand while you're playing on the TV. That's what they're doing. Not all that revolutionary. And Sony, God only knows what they're doing. They don't have a clue what's going on. They continue to make the same mistakes over and over again, and who even knows if they're going to be a contender the next generation around. The PS3 is selling okay, but I tend to believe that it's the Blu-ray player. They chase the movies. That's how they got that console to work out. Look at the PS Vita. It's dying on the vine. Right? No matter what anybody says, it's dying on the vine. So, what's left to chase? It's an interesting thought process, is it not? What's left to accomplish? How far away is holodeck technology? Well, we've just recently, mind you, in the last year or two, managed to get a three-dimensional hologram that doesn't disappear when you walk around it in 360 degrees. That's the apex of our technology at this moment. We have got a three-dimensional hologram that looks okay. It looks more like what you would see in Star Wars when they projected Princess Leia out. That's what we've got now. Now, what's next? How do we make that move? Holodecks require solid holograms, right? You're not going to be convinced that you're in a holographic room if you have to sit in one place and things move around you and you have to put on glasses or whatever. We've tried that. The virtual reality thing. We tried that. That didn't work. Maybe that is what's next. Maybe some sort of augmented reality is what's coming next. Maybe that's what we're going to chase. Google's betting big money on it with their Google glasses, right? That's been the new big thing. The only real driving technology that's going on out there. Really, if you think about it. What's new, different, and sci-fi that we can't do yet? Well, augmented vision. I mean, personally, ever since I saw them bolt that screen over RoboCop's face in RoboCop when they put that computer screen in front of him so he could do computer-assisted targeting, that's what I've been waiting for. Some sort of, not augmented reality. We've got that now, and it's, eh. But something where you become part of the environment in a way that is not superficial. I think that's the future of technology. What I can't wait for? I can't wait to be sitting in a chair with this little pair of Google goggles on, playing Robotron, right? The glasses are reading my hand controls. I'm actually pretending I'm holding dual joystick controls, and I'm playing good old-fashioned Robotron in these little glasses, sitting in my chair, something you would have never thought you could do. That's what drives technology. That's how tech evolves. Coming up with things you never thought you could ever possibly do. Well, I hope you enjoyed the editorial commentary. I thought it was an interesting topic. I'd love to hear your comments and thoughts on the matter. What technology are we chasing? What's next? What's the next big thing to push technology? Pornography? 3D isn't doing it. Right? Sony's trying to push this 4K TV. Right? They're trying to move forward. Well, everyone's got a high-def TV. We need to make them buy something else. So what's next? A 4K TV. Unbelievable. So I'd love to hear your thoughts. Join us at go to RetroGamingRadio.com. Join us on our forums. Let's talk about it. I'd love to hear your thoughts and your opinions on what the future is for technology and how it's going to affect gaming. With so many anniversaries coming due, 20-year, 25-year, 30-year, 35-year, 40-year anniversaries in the gaming field, I chose to do something a little different this month, namely because this information is starting to fleet away from me. I realized how much of it I had forgotten, how much of it I no longer have available, how a record, a written history of my own is missing. So I spent many, many hours digging together as much information I could about my software company, my shareware company, Dark Unicorn Productions. Dark Unicorn Productions is celebrating its 20th year. 20th year. It's hard to believe. 20 years ago was the very first incarnation of Dark Unicorn Productions. So let's talk about that. Dark Unicorn Productions originally started back in 1992 to publish a disc cataloging utility called PowerCat. This was written by myself and by my shipmate, at the time I was in the military, by a guy by the name of Dale McBain. We came up with an idea. We weren't happy with the disc catalog. There really wasn't any disc cataloging utilities, and those that were didn't work the way that we liked them to. So we came up with this, and we decided, you know what, let's share this. Let's share this with the world. But we needed a name. And Dark Unicorn Productions is what we came up with. Over the years, I've been asked time and time again, what does this mean? What does Dark Unicorn Productions mean? Where does it hail from? What's the backstory? Because almost every name from the old days has a backstory. Nowadays, you just pick whatever name is hip, you know. Hip. You pick something out of the dictionary. You pick the word of the week. You pick something that has some sort of a, current stature to it. But back then, much like, you know, old garage bands would name their bands after one of the singer's girlfriends or something like that, there's always some kind of story behind it. And Dark Unicorn Productions is no exception. Many of you know the story, but many of you do not. So I'm going to set you hip right now, today, on where Dark Unicorn Productions got its name. Back in those days, and slightly there earlier, one of our favorite games of all time, myself and Dale McBain's, was Archon from Electronic Arts. Archon was a fantasy chess game where the pieces would actually fight each other. Not like battle chess, not where it was just predetermined. It's not just chess with animation. This was literally, you kill the other player, you take the square. You die, you lose it. And Archon was filled with all sorts of little eccentricities. First of all, Archon had power points. And power points were proof against magic. So if you had a piece sitting on a power point, the opponent, the enemy, could not cast a spell on you like imprison or banish or any of these other things. So power points were protection. Some of the board was black and white, but other parts of the board were rotating in color. Every single move, every single turn, the board colors would go from white to dark. From light to dark. And there were always somewhere in between. Well, if you were the light side, and you landed on a light square, white or light, your piece automatically had more power, more energy. Likewise, if you attacked a piece on a dark square, you lost energy. You went in weaker. It was a pretty cool game. Look it up if you've never seen it. The light side, both, by the way, they weren't the same size. The pieces weren't the same on both sides. Each side had their own types of pieces, similar in design but different creatures. For example, on the light side, you had sorceress. On the dark side, you had a wizard, right? Same kind of idea, but different pieces. On the light side, you had... let's see, what was one of the other light side pieces? A genie. The dark side had a shapeshifter, right? So they had all of these, they had different fantasy pieces on both sides. By far, the unicorn, which was exclusive to the light side, the unicorn was by far and away the most, at least on the Commodore 64 version, was the most powerful piece on the board. If, at least against the computer, pretty much, unless you were really bad at it, you could take the unicorn, pick it up with your wizard or sorceress, I can't remember which side was which now, but literally transport it to the back row of the dark side and systematically wipe out their pieces one at a time. It was fast, it ran fast, it shot fast, and it didn't get stuck. They had these things that grew on the playfield, and sometimes you get stuck. The unicorn would quickly and nimbly move around those. So, in all honesty, at least again on the Commodore 64 version, the unicorn was by far and away the most powerful piece on the board. Okay, so now we got the unicorn, but what about this dark unicorn? When you played against the computer, which most of us did because there was no internet back then, and your friends could only come over on the weekend, so during the week you had to play by yourself, especially if you were an only child like me. So you would play the computer a lot. And I always played the light side because I always wanted the unicorn. The dark side had a shapeshifter. And the shapeshifter would assume the identity of any piece that it attacked or that attacked him. The shapeshifter itself would never fight. If you put a golem on a shapeshifter, he turned into a golem. If you put a djinn on the shapeshifter, he turned into a djinn. You get the idea? Shapeshifter. You never fought with a shapeshifter. You fought against the same guy. Mirror match, right? For you in the middle school age of gaming. Mirror match. Here's the thing. The dark side was very, 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 at least the computer was, mindful of light and dark flows of time on the board. And essentially, unless you attacked him, the shapeshifter would never attack on a light square. It would always attack on a dark square. And if you had a unicorn at some point in time, if you were trying to wipe out the back row, or if you were using that unicorn to single-handedly rape this game over the coals, then eventually the shapeshifter and the unicorn would square off. And they made sure that that shapeshifter stayed on the dark squares. So, your unicorn would go in as the light unicorn on a dark square, immediately at a disadvantage, and the shapeshifter would shift into a dark unicorn and have tons more energy than you did going in. So in reality, the most powerful piece in Archon was the Dark Unicorn. Hence the name, Dark Unicorn Productions. Now the slogan or the tagline for Dark Unicorn Productions back at that time was, One Step Above Excellence. The Unicorn logo, the one that you've probably seen before, the one with the side view of the head with the mane kind of flowing over the neck, was drawn up by a guy named Mike Hall. And Mike Hall was also one of my fellow shipmates aboard the submarine I was on. The dream of Dark Unicorn Productions was to give independent developers someplace to go. The concept was that alone we're weak, but together we could be strong. You know, this was back before the internet, before distribution, before so many things. And to be noticed and seen and recognized as an independent developer, totally off the hook. So the goal was, listen, maybe we can get other people together. Maybe we can get other independent developers that don't have a brand or a moniker of their own and give them some place to be. Together we can be Dark Unicorn Productions. So in 1993, I saw this porn game. Again, you know, 93, I was a young man. Of course, I was going to partake. There was a porn game on the Amiga called Blue Angel 69. Aside from the porn aspect of it, it was actually a very clever game. And I said, well, you know, it's a shame that the world that's not into porn or, you know, PG-13 gaming, because let's be honest, it wasn't exactly porn. It was tasteful nudes, you know, and there were robot chicks, you know, so come on. So I said to myself, you know, it's a shame that nobody gets to play this game because it's an adult title. It's not going to get widespread. So I created and enhanced the concept of Blue Angel 69 and created a game called Psycho Squares. And it was moderately received. People liked the gameplay. But it really wasn't until later, in 1993, when Michael Welch joined Dark Unicorn Productions with his insane hit, Scorched Tanks. Now, if you were an Amiga user and an Amiga owner, you know what Scorched Tanks is. You may think, oh, well, I've heard of Scorched Earth. Well, it's kind of like that. But Scorched Tanks was the evolution of Scorched Earth and the artillery games in general, namely because it was one of the very first, in fact, I believe it was the first artillery game that the landscape would scroll. Well, now we've got it all over the place, right? We got Worms, we've got Warheads, we've got tons of games that have came since that are scrolling battlefields that are artillery-style games. As far as I know, Scorched Tanks was the first. And this was huge. Not only did Michael Welch brand it and advertise it as a Dark Unicorn Productions game, he also did one of the very first intros for Dark Unicorn Production. This was going on with other software. Some sort of a cool introduction. Some sort of a CG-rendered, cool-looking intro. Psygnosis was all over it, if you remember from last month's show. But not only did he bring this great game, but he also set the bar very high for us, trying to make the DUP, or the Dark Unicorn Productions brand, something special. So he had a cool intro on Scorched Tanks. And Scorched Tanks, by the way, made Michael a lot of money. Scorched Tanks, now, we didn't see any of it. That was part of the deal. Dark Unicorn Productions was an umbrella, not a publishing company. So Michael never turned over any of his profits to us. Whatever you wrote, you kept. The idea was that we would share a brand. Now, this was written in AMOS, which is a programming language which many people shunned because it was just like any other high-level BASIC. You could do great things with it, or you could do really horrible things, and unfortunately, a lot of people saw a lot of horrible things. But this one not only put Dark Unicorn Productions on the map, but it suddenly made AMOS something to be reckoned with. Anyway, it won awards, magazines talked about it. And later on, it went on to become Pocket Tanks, which is available on the PC. And I think he's got it out for Mac and iOS as well. Now, he's working on an Android version. I'm patiently awaiting. Let's see. So he published that under the name of Blitwise Productions after DUP kind of dissolved. And we're going to get to that in a minute. About that time, Troy Tulu, which of course you've heard numerous talks about him on this show, my other shows, Troy Tulu has always had this financial bug. He worked for a title company as a teenager in his early 20s. He's always been somewhere involved in finance. And he was really pissed that the Amiga had no good top-notch financial software. So he was going to use his expertise to create a top-notch Amiga version of some sort of a financial program. So he joined the group right about 1993. After seeing Scorched Tanks just skyrocket, and after seeing his intro and everything else, I was pushed myself to make a new game of Psycho Squares called Psycho Squares Deluxe. I improved the graphics. I used samples of my wife being a nag. There's all sorts of stories behind Psycho Squares. I improved the AI, and I created a means to use expansion discs, because the original game had 13 levels of increasing difficulty, and once you were done, then, the idea was to reveal the graphics behind the blocks, behind the tiles. So once you ran out of graphics, it was kind of over. So I released two expansion discs. One was Calvin and Hobbes, which, of course, I had absolutely no permission to release. I had no written permission. That was back in the old days when you could get away with copyright infringement. Nobody cared. And I also created an adult expansion disc. They were both released the same year. I did choose my wife's voice because it was very, very grating. So when the computer would play, and it worked. I'm telling you, listen, this is my ex-wife, so I can say whatever the hell I want. my ex-wife, I told her I needed a female voice because people liked female voices in games. What I didn't tell her is I wanted it because her voice was annoying. And there were things that the computer would prompt you and make you try to move. If you were taking too long, it'd be like, hurry up, you know, hurry up, come on, come on. So it would try to egg you on and make you, you know, make a move that maybe wasn't the best move for you. Sold a couple hundred copies. One of the biggest famous things from that game was the running unicorn at the beginning. It had a very cool graphic done by a guy named Charles Caffrey. He did this beautiful, it was grayscale, but it looked fantastic. It looked like a 3D rendered unicorn running across the screen. That was my way to kind of one-up Michael Welch and his cool intro for Dark Unicorn Productions. And again, you know, that was one of the first uses of that new logo, again, that Mike Hall created, and it's still in use. It's never been upgraded. Part of the charm of it is that it kind of has that, it still looks really good, even if it's high resolution, but it's still got that, we come from the past, we're classic gamer type things. Now, one of the interesting things was, this is sort of a neat little slice into Amiga development. The Amiga had, you probably have heard this, if you didn't own an Amiga, you probably were jealous of something called ham mode, hold and modify, which boasted, and this of course was on all of Amiga literature, and you'd swear that this was a regular deal, that the Amiga could support a 4096 color image. This is true. However, you couldn't do much with it. Hold and modify was a very freaky graphics hack, and we're going to talk about that on a future show when I talk about the Amiga. But what you could do was something called extra half-bright mode. An extra half-bright mode lets you have, in addition to the regular standard no-frills 32 colors that the regular Amiga would let you do with no restrictions, it allowed you to do half-bright colors of the 32. Effectively, you would have blue and half as bright blue, red and half as bright red. And you could address all 64 of those colors at one time. So what I did is I used a very modest color palette for all of the UI. I got it to the point to where I used 8 colors on the UI and say 56 colors for the graphics behind the tiles. And it really made a big difference. It was a really cool use of graphics, but it was very painstaking to do this. And one of my friends at the time, still my friend, I just haven't talked to him in a long time, named Adam Burns, he ran one of the local Amiga users groups. He liked to play with graphics, and so I asked him if he would work on making 56 color graphics, and he did. It's also worth noting that Psycho Squares Deluxe, not the first one, but the second one, was fully hard drive installable. For those of you who come back from the old Amiga days, that's huge. Late 1993, I set up my first bulletin board system, my first BBS, Dark Unicorn Productions World Headquarters. 1993, if you also remember, the movie Tombstone came out. Tombstone made a very big impression on me. The film was fantastic. I'm not a Western fan, but Tombstone I must have seen like 30 times in the theater. That's how great it was for me. And I still love it. It's still one of my favorite movies. But I thought it'd be great to name my bulletin board Tombstone. And I ran this on my Amiga, in my house, on a second phone line. This is how we did it old school, folks, for those of you who may not remember. So essentially it was a one-line BBS. So when somebody called in, the line was busy. And when he got off, the next person could call. Now, since I had the bulletin board local, I could log in as a second user while somebody else was on the BBS using it as well. It was pretty cool. So Tombstone BBS was born because we didn't have the internet. How are we supposed to distribute our shareware? How are we supposed to have a place to get patches or things like that? We needed a distribution methodology. And, you know, this was before a lot of the big names like CompuServe and whatnot came out. So, oddly enough, all of the Dark Unicorn Productions members or friends of Dark Unicorn Productions had their own special handle or login name for Tombstone BBS. I was Wyatt Earp. My friend John Graham, we're going to talk about him. He went by the nickname Virtuality. Seamus McNally went by Longbow. Troy went by Spider. Peter Olofsson, who you might recognize the name as a writer for Amiga World, he was a freelance writer, I think, and he did a lot of Amiga stuff. He was a really good friend of Dark Unicorn Productions. He went under the nickname of Peter Roo. Kit Felice went under Captain Psycho. Dale McBain went as Morgan Earp. And Mike Hall went as Doc Holliday. Kind of fun, right? This is back when this sort of stuff meant anything. If you didn't recognize some of those names, it's okay because some of them we haven't talked about yet. In 1994, Seamus McNally joined the team. He was working on a side-scrolling shooter called Flying Tigers. This was an arcade part simulation, but really a really, really nice-looking AGA Amiga 1200 type game. He was working on it. It looked fantastic, and we were very excited for him to join the team. In late December 1994, we started an online magazine called the Dark Unicorn Dispatch. It ran from December 94 to June of 95. It started off as a plain text file. This is great. You can find these things if you search the internet. These are still out there. Then we changed them to Amiga Guide format, which was it was really cool, Amiga Guide format. It's something we probably should talk about, but I'll save that for the Amiga show. Amiga Guide was sort of like an early interactive web page, but was in a self-contained file. I'll talk more about that another time. So we created that because I'm always looking to fill some void that's missing something, right? And what we didn't have was really good coverage. And plus, you know, let's whore our products while we're doing it. So we created the Dark Unicorn Dispatch. Also in 1994, part of what prompted us to create the Dispatch, because we really wanted to get the PR machine moving, John Graham and I were best of buddies. And, you know, I'm trying to remember exactly how we met, and it's just escaping my mind. Good close friend of the family. He's my daughter's godfather, although I doubt if anything ever happened to me, she would ever go to him. She doesn't really even know him. But he was the godfather. And when you've heard me say the term John Graham Jr., that's him. John and I bought a Sega Genesis for one purpose. We wanted to play Mortal Kombat 2. At that point in time, you have to remember that Mortal Kombat on the NES, or the SNES rather, was censored. There was no blood. And nobody knew at that point in time that Nintendo was going to reverse that decision for Mortal Kombat 2. Plus, Sega was very, very smart. They paid a claim to release Mortal Kombat like 2 or 4 weeks early on the Sega Genesis. So John and I picked one of these Genesises up. There you go. We picked up a Sega Genesis, and we started playing the crap out of Mortal Kombat 2. John fell in love with the Genesis. In fact, he ended up getting a Sega CD add-on for the Genesis. This is when we were introduced to a little game you might have heard of called Tomcat. Tomcat is a full-motion video game. Now, most of you who've listened to my show, who've heard me talk, I love full-motion video games, if they're done right. I've always been fascinated. For me, that was the dream. That was the dream I was chasing. Digital graphics. I wanted realism. And I'm sure it was in no small part to Dragon's Lair. I wanted video gaming to be real. And I remember my mom used to always ask. Every time I'd upgrade my computer, I'd get a new one. And I would show her how great it is. She'd be like, meh. And then I'd show her some magazine article or something. And she'd be like, well, why can't the game look like that? It's like, well, Mom, that's like a cartoon. We're not going to get that. That's not going to happen. You know, this is what we got, and it looks really cool. Here's Defender of the Crown. Doesn't that look cool? It's like, eh. So I probably got some of that from my mom. Anyway, John Graham was totally infatuated with Tomcat, and so was I. John decided he wanted to take Tomcat and turn it into an Amiga game. Now, that's no mean feat, all right? That's insane. You're talking about taking a professional, you know, it wasn't First Party, I don't think. I can't remember who published it, who published Tomcat. That was a big name publisher, big name developer on a CD. John said, I can do that. I can make that game. So he went to the library. He got a whole bunch of public domain Navy videos. And while he denies it, I know for a fact he swiped a bunch of graphics out of the Sega CD version. He created Tomcat FMV for the Amiga in 1994. Now listen, whether you like full motion video games or not, this was it. This is a shareware game, no internet, no commercial advertising, sold, get this, thousands of copies. Major magazines were covering the game and covering Dark Unicorn Productions. John paid his house off with the proceeds he got from Tomcat. It was the biggest shareware game for the Amiga of all time, weighing in at 6 discs. It wasn't until later on that, like, Beneath a Steel Sky and what were some of the other ones? Dreamweb. Some of those really gigantic, huge, hand-drawn type adventures came out. It was the biggest game ever for the Amiga. Oddly enough, because the way that the Amiga works, and we're going to talk more about this when we discuss the Amiga, there was a problem with something called chip memory. I guess we can talk about it. Why not? We're already here. The Amiga computer, as great as it was, had a couple of Achilles heels. First of all, an unexpanded Amiga came with something called chip RAM, and only chip RAM. Chip RAM was great. It was memory that was local to the graphics and sound chips. So instead of having to go through a memory bus, it was essentially like having direct read-write access to the chip, to the memory, which let the Amiga do amazing things. But there was a problem with chip memory. It fragmented. In other words, let's say that you had 1 megabyte of chip memory. You made a huge graphic on the screen and allocated 10% of the memory. And then you did it again, and you did it again, and you did this 10 times. Then you suddenly wanted a graphic that was 20%. Even though the other memory wasn't in use anymore, it had been given back, the fragmentation of the memory would immediately tell the Amiga it's out of memory. So no matter how much chip RAM you had free, eventually the chip RAM would fragment. Now, a company named Prairie Software came up with something called HyperCache that swore, I still don't know if this is true or not, they swore that they could prevent chip RAM fragmentation. Now, listen, this is essentially interactive video. This is Dragon's Lair on the Amiga, essentially, but only with Tomcats and, you know, naval vessels. So every time you loaded a video clip, it would take a chunk of memory, you'd be done with the video clip, it'd give the memory back, but it would be, exactly, fragmented. And at some point in time, that fragmented memory would crap the game out. So we spent a lot of time working on it. Now, if you had fast RAM, or add-on RAM, expansion RAM, no problems at all. It was okay. But, you know, this was a huge problem, and this is one of the reasons why it never made it to the CD32. Other than the fact that we didn't have a developer's license and we weren't likely to get one. They wanted like 50 grand for a developer's license for the CD32. Get out of here with that. So that's one of the reasons why Tomcat never made it to the CD32. This was so popular. Get this. This is so popular, this game was. The shareware version, which came on, I think, 3 discs. People called long distance to Tombstone BBS from Europe, Germany, Switzerland, you name it. People were calling Tombstone to download the demo. Now, one of the cool things is it actually required a hard drive to install. So Dark Unicorn was kind of on the cutting edge. There were almost no hard drive installable games for the Amiga, period. And this was, I believe, it might have even been the first one. I really don't know for sure. It might have been the first Amiga game that required hard drive install. And obviously so. Just the nature of the beast. In the game, if you've ever played the game, when you die, there's a guy there that shakes his head and he throws a blanket over you like the Undertaker does in, Mad Dog McCree? That is John Graham Jr. himself playing the Undertaker. Thanks to Tomcat and thanks to Scorched Tanks, Dark Unicorn Productions became huge. We had a huge European audience, which is weird, right? We're like the David Hasselhoff of Amiga programming. Anyway, we had a couple of really good friends that helped us out. Peter Olofsson, which I mentioned earlier, and Tim Walsh, they were both journalists, and they wrote for various Amiga magazines. And they really made sure that we got coverage. And I'm really appreciative. If Peter Olofsson or somebody who knows Peter is running around out there listening to the show, he was a huge help to us. He was a really great guy. A guy by the name of Kit Felice, under the name PsychoSoft, joined us in 1995. He had a game called It's the Pits, A Bold Miner's Slaughter. Yeah, you heard that right. Kit had created this mammoth Boing demo. Do you remember the Amiga ball bouncing demo? It had that big red checkered ball and it bounced inside of like this three-dimensional box. It was really cool and it had stereo sound and it sounded really cool. He did a mammoth Boing demo where it was the same thing, only the ball was like three times bigger than the screen. It was the coolest damn effect I'd ever seen. And when I saw that, I wrote to him. He'd had a game also out called Gladiators of Dagania. And I wrote to him, I said, listen, you got to join our team, man. We're putting together some good stuff. You've heard about Tomcat. You've heard about Scorched Tanks. I want your next game to be under the Dark Unicorn umbrella. So he created the game. It's the Pits of Bold Miner Slaughter, which is cool. It was a combination of a 3D tunnel chase, like you see all the time now on mobile phones, and a kind of a reinvention of thrust or a gravity type game. It was really cool. It was a fun as hell game. And he was a very eccentric guy, Kit Felice. And we're going to talk more about him later. But, you know, again, we didn't live nearby each other. I never met the guy personally. We chatted in emails and online and that sort of thing. But, you know, I never met the guy personally. The GIF file format by 1995 was huge. PCs were getting it, and porn and everything. I mean, porn was getting big, right? Again, we talked about this earlier on. If you listen to the Technology Chase editorial, pornography, the GIF format was really driving pornography. People wanted to be able to look at GIF images on their Amiga. Now, the Amiga did not have the ability to view GIFs coming out of the box. And so I found a command line utility in the public domain that was hard as hell to use. Nobody knew how to use it. In fact, nobody even knew it existed. This guy threw it together and he didn't get any sort of kudos. It's in the documentation somewhere. But I created something. I put a front end on it, jazzed it up, and I called it the GPP or the GIF Processor Plus. And the GIF Processor Plus was actually, considering that we're a gaming company, was our second app. And the GIF Processor Plus was amazing. We didn't charge for it. It was free, basically because I didn't want any... Because remember, CompuServe back then owned GIF, right? And they got really nasty about it. Was it CompuServe? I think it was CompuServe that owned GIF. Anyway, somebody owned GIF, and so that's why it was called GPP. I never wanted to call it GIF because I didn't want these guys coming down. But in early 1995, after we had all of this success, the online service Genie created a support forum, get this, on Genie. Dark Unicorn Productions had a Genie presence. We were allowed to get on Genie and go into our chat areas, our forum posting areas for free. This was back when they charged you by the minute to get on these services. So as long as we were in a Dark Unicorn Productions area, we were able to be online for free. That was huge. Plus, it really gave us an opportunity. You got to think, this is 95, man. Look how long ago this was. We were actually essentially on an internet chat room back in 1995. A group by the name of Better Concepts Incorporated contacted us and said, listen, we want to distribute your software, not just the shareware stuff. We want to sell the commercial versions. This was back, you know, and Tomcat was selling tons. And John, that's all John did all day was copy discs. That's what he did all day. 9 discs at a time, 3 or 4 minutes a disc. Took forever. So Better Concepts said, listen, we're going to take a cut of the profit, but we'll do all the disc duplication. We'll mail the discs. We'll take the orders. Well, you guys can get back to writing games. So that sounded like a good deal to me. A guy by the name of Eric Geske, also known as Sidewinder. If you're from the old Amiga days, you probably remember Sidewinder. He did music for a new version of Scorched Tanks that Michael Welsh had put out. And he agreed to join DUP as sort of our music guy. And we had great plans for Sidewinder. We wanted him to do all the music for our games, etc. That was really hard because none of us were musically inclined. None of us were really graphically inclined. We were programmers, and we did the best we could. So him joining up was huge for us. We really were excited to have him available to do music and audio type stuff for us. About that time frame, I was looking for a new game. I didn't really want to do any more Psycho Squares. I was kind of done with that. It was fun. I've always been Probably because the first computer that I ever laid my hands on, the first real game I ever played on a computer, was the old Star Trek game. This was the one where you had like a 9x9 universe. Each of the quadrants of the universe had a 9x9 sectors, and you moved your starship around with basic rudimentary text commands. Not even animated. It was just, you know, use impulse drive here. And there were so many Klingons, so many star bases, and you had X number of days to rid the universe of Klingons. Always been fascinated by that, and I've always thought that there was a way that you could make that exciting to play. Well, being in the military, I was in the Navy, I came up with a great idea where I was going to combine the success of John Graham's full motion video with this classic Trek game, and I was going to combine this and use all these cool effects that I was working on. I had tons of stuff going on, so I was really excited to get into that, and I don't remember exactly how far I got. Better Concepts called me up, though, and he said, they said, listen, we want you to work on a CD32 project. And I was excited. I was really excited to work on a CD-based project. But unfortunately, they said, listen, we're going to fund you. We're going to pay you. You know, this is going to be like a total commercial product. We've got a CD32 developer's kit. We own one. We'll do everything. But we need you to make it. So Fleet Commander got bumped onto the back burner. Didn't have any time. Right now, at this point in time, right in this, and again, this is why I needed to get this all documented, because I don't have exact time frames for any of this stuff. Right about that time, John was still trying to get Tomcat working on the CD32. Unfortunately, that chip memory thing was just simply unsurmountable. There was nothing we could do about it. And since the CD32 had no easy way of expanding memory, it just really wasn't going to work out. Unfortunately, about that time, Seamus and I had a falling out. And I know it was about Flying Tigers, but I don't remember what it was specifically over. I don't. And I remember there was some bad blood going around. Also in early 95, Kit Felice and I said, listen, we need to combine our forces here. This is about the time I'd finished up the Top Secret project, and I was looking for another thing to do. And, you know, Kit had told me about this unbelievable gory game that he had in mind. And, you know, with a game like A Bold Miner's Slaughter, this guy may have had a couple of screws loose, okay? But it was my kind of screws he had loose, and I was really excited about it. And we were going to do this huge gore-fest game. But in 1995, something else happened, namely the internet. John had given up on doing the CD32 version of Tomcat. He was eager to get another full motion video game out into the gaming force before people forgot about it, right? So he started making a helicopter simulator called Desert Apache. Now, one of the things that made Tomcat kind of sucky was that you played it in a little tiny postage stamp window. You know, standard full motion video stuff back then. He wanted a full screen deal. Well, Seamus McNally wrote John a full screen machine language level scaling routine. I don't know anything about it. The two of them worked in cahoots. All I know is Desert Apache went from being a postage stamp game into a full screen full motion video game. It was unbelievable. The first time I saw it, I about crap my pants. I'm not kidding you. It was just that frickin' cool. In May, the internet was hot for Dark Unicorn Productions. Our very first website went up in 1995 in May, hosted on Eskimo.com. A guy named, Daniel Rizzet, something like that, he agreed to host the site for us. And I still have the URL of the original site. It doesn't work anymore, and the Wayback Machine won't pick it up, so you can't go back and see it. But I do have the URL for posterity. Late 1995, John finished up Desert Apache. And again, it was a full-motion video game. It was a helicopter. It was above and beyond what Tomcat was. Tomcat was a ripoff of Tomcat. Desert Apache was a brand new property. It had never been done. No one had ever had a game like that. He created all sorts of different types of missions. He had rescue missions. He had, it was incredible. I mean, literally, it was absolutely insane. It was far better. It was a far better game than Tomcat. Just like before, a hard drive was required, but this time it only came on four discs. He was very clever. He used, he stole from Dragon's Lair. He used, reversed videos and things like that to really drag it out. He made a ton of cash. It wasn't Tomcat money, but he made a lot of money on Desert Apache. We, had another guy join up in 1995. Let's put it this way. 94-95 was it for Dark Unicorn Productions. We were just on fire. Sean Emerson joined. He had a thing called the War Games Processor, which was some sort of a project. You know, I was never really completely clear on it. I was just happy to have another person to publish for, or publish with, I should say. This was like based on, you know, the old Avalon Hill stuff. So he was making something that would actually create these sort of titles or something. But that was the only title he ever released with a DUP moniker. And it was a very short-lived arrangement. Things kind of started to go south. I started working on a game. My at the time, in 95, I was really into Pente, which is sort of another version of Go. And I thought, you know what would make this game kick so much butt? Magic, right? So I set out. I started working on a game called Djinn, The Battle of the Stones. Now, Djinn I was very excited about after... what was the name of that Wes Craven flick? Wishmaster, right? So I was really into genies back then. So Djinn, the Battle of the Stones, was essentially Pente with magic. I was very excited, very, very excited to work on this game. So John, again, he's rolling in cash. He's keeping the full motion video game train rolling. And he came up with a title called No Strike Baseball, which would be a full motion video, full game of baseball. Well, on and off over the past couple of, how long did it take? 8 months? I told you about a top secret CD32 project I was working on, funded by Better Concepts. Well, in late 1995, it actually got released. And what this was an adult title. Now listen, porn was huge. Better Concepts was working both sides of the field, right? They were selling Amiga shareware and software. But on the other side of the building, these guys were selling these bootleg graphic discs of essentially porn. I mean, they didn't even have titles. They just said GIF Disc 1, GIF Disc 2, GIF Disc 3, and every disc had like 10,000 naked chicks on it. I mean, that's what they were doing. And they were selling them for $4 or $5 a piece. They were making a killing. They wanted to take and get in on some of that adult cash on the Amiga. So they said, we want the ultimate Amiga title, Amiga adult title for the CD32 and disc-based Amigas. There were still a couple of Amigas out there that had CD-ROM drives. So you could still, they wanted to be able to make use of that, but they really wanted a CD32 game that they could sell to Europe, as well as make tons of money in the U.S. So they hired me. They said, listen, we will provide you with anything you need. We've got porn coming out the yin-yang. We can give you hundreds, thousands of pictures. We can give you tons of pictures. He said, now, video is another story. And I said, well, we can cover the video. We had just gotten, John was already using a video digitizing unit. It was pretty good quality. He had enough money. He should have been able to buy something good. So we set out and we found as close to public domain adult videos as we could find. And we snuck out clips of the videos. I took all of that and created what I've got to admit, it's some of my best work. It's unfortunate that I can't, you know, not everybody can appreciate the subject matter. But the disc was called Your Privacy Assured. And it came on this cool yellow disc that said YPA on it. And it actually had the Dark Unicorn. It didn't have the logo on the cover, but it did have it in the game. And it was one of the, there was all sorts of cool technology being used in there. First of all, I had the GIF Processor Plus. So I spent a good month gathering assets, running all of these GIFs through this, GIF processor. Now here's the fun part. GIFs took a long time to convert. a long time, like 10 minutes apiece. So I would literally set up a batch of 100 overnight. Every single night of the week, I would set these up to transcode. Now, the GIFs had some sort of an interlace. Some of the GIFs that went through the system were interlaced. So what happened is when they came out of the other end as an IFF file on the Amiga, they would look stretched or crunched. So I had to throw those away. But over the course of time, I managed to get through hundreds of these pictures. Of course, we had the videos, so we had that. But the guys wanted something interactive. So Better Concept said, listen, we want something naughty. We want something interactive. We want something real. And I said, so, okay, what did you have in mind? He said, I don't know, you know, you're the developer, you come up with something. This is the idea of what we want. So I came up with something called Girls Interactive. Again, I'm a pioneer. I've always been a pioneer. People just don't know it. Girls Interactive featured an insanely attractive naked woman on the screen, and your goal was to make her climax. That's the proper family-friendly version of it. To do that, you had to find out what she liked. Now, women, you should be happy. I was actually trying to promote foreplay here. So the idea was is you would select some sort of an action and then some part of her body. And if she liked it, then it wasn't like a Simon thing, but you had to know what order to kind of put things in to make her excited, right? And if you did something wrong, she'd get pissed off. And this was not animated. This was a still thing. But we still needed a voice, right? If we had a real audio, we could pull this off. So I talked to John. My friend John was into everything. Man, that guy is just crazy. Anyway, he had a bisexual girlfriend, okay? And I told him, I said, listen, your girl's got to run in some crazy circles. I said, I want to hire somebody to come in here and moan and cry out and scream and do all this crazy stuff on audio that I can put into this game. And he said, you know what? I think I've got just the girl. And I said, great. And so I called Better Concepts and I said, I need money. He said, well, how much money do you need? I said, I need like $500. I said, I want to hire somebody to come in. And he goes, well, it's a lot of money. And I said, well, you know, you want it done right. So I got some cash. I don't remember what the final amount was, but I got money to hire this girl. Now, here's the funny part. The girl that came over absolutely had a great sexy voice, and she was perfect for the role. She looked nothing at all like the picture that you end up playing in the game. That's the magic of Hollywood, people. I can never look at that game again and not think about how polar opposite the girl is making the voices. So it was a very, very, as adult type titles go, they sold a ton of them. I saw some nice money out of it, and frankly, it's some of my best work to date. And again, you know, it's unfortunate that it had to be an adult title, but Your Privacy Assured was a big thing, even though it didn't get us the kind of press that the other stuff did. November 1995 came around, and I got out of the Navy. That really hurt Dark Unicorn Productions. I had to go get a real job. I had to move back in with my parents. I got divorced. I filed bankruptcy. I lost everything. It was the end of 95 was not very pleasant. I was happy to get out of the military. That was part of the game plan, but my wife and I were going through troubled times, probably because I made her do grinding voices on my games. No, that wasn't it. It was a whole other story, but suffice to say that didn't work out very well, and DUP was pretty much dead come 1996. Sadly enough, Kit Felice in 1996, and I don't have a lot of details, and no, it's not available. At some point, I had emails galore about this stuff. Kit Felice, like I said, he had a couple of screws loose. He was he was a genius, very talented guy. But in 1996, he took his own life. He committed suicide. And that was the first of the deaths of Dark Unicorn Productions people. It kind of got worse from there, oddly enough. In 1996, John moved to Florida, oddly enough, to work for, what was that name of that show that Ed McMahon was doing? Star Search. Yeah, he weren't there. He was working as some sort of a technical advisor over there. He said Ed McMahon was a real dick, for what it's worth. Can I say that? This is a family-friendly show, but he was not a very nice guy. Well, the heat between Seamus and I finally came to a head. He left Dark Unicorn Productions and formed a company called Digital Longbow, and created. He went ahead and ported Flying Tigers from the Amiga to the PC platform. He went on to do some other stuff too. He also did some sort of a tank. I can't remember the name of the tank battle, but he did a tank attack game. But yeah, he went on to get some, he went on to gain some fame. Michael left as well. He formed Blitwise Productions and he started running with Pocket Tanks, which he's still doing today, along with some other stuff. In the late 1990s, after I'd gotten out of the military, I'd gotten myself kind of squared away. The next big thing on the horizon, we're always looking at that, right, is technological people. The next big thing at the end of the 90s was MP3. Now, in order to understand just how innovative I really was, I'm sorry, I'm patting myself on the back just a little bit this episode. In the early days, again, you know, we kind of had internet, but it's not the internet you see today. We had no Napster. We had none of this stuff. So MP3s were a quietly exchanged commodity. Inter-relay chatter, IRC, was the definitive place to meet and swap MP3s. Now listen, any song you want on the planet, if you go to Google and search for it, go to a search engine, go to the web, go to Usenet, go to some illicit source, you can get any song you want in MP3, whether or not it's legal or not. But back then, you know, there was no preordained audience. People have been doing MP3 stuff since the, you know, 1999. So you benefit from that today, right? You're talking about 13 years of people taking recordings off their albums and tapes and finding all of this disparate material that's never going to be for sale again. And they've got these MP3s and they've been traded around, and we had Napster and we had all this stuff. But back then, MP3s were a mystery to most people. And what really made MP3s a pain in the butt was you could play them for free. A company by the name of Fraunhofer actually still owns MP3. And they created the Fraunhofer decoder. And they gave that away. It was very brilliant of their part. They said, listen, anybody who wants can play back MP3s. We'll let you license the technology. It'll cost you nothing. And you can play back MP3s. But to make them is going to cost you. So they released, this is what came out, a DOS command line encoder. That's it. Oh, and you couldn't rip it off a CD. You had to rip the WAV file off the CD yourself, feed the WAV file on the command line with 900 million parameters, and then wait for about 5 minutes a song for them to convert and encode. Yeah, what you've got today, being able to stick a disc in and hit a button, totally different deal. Well, command line's great. Most people like the command line, especially back then, the hackers and the crackers. They love that stuff. Command line all the way. In fact, UIs or GUIs were like almost Satan's tool. Well, I was very big in the MP3 scene. Huge, in fact. I brought a number of songs to, I brought a number of pieces of music to the scene that just weren't available. Things that could not be obtained by normal people. And I won't go into great detail about that. But, you know, there are times in life when you can say, I was there. You know, let's say that you were, you were at a big earthquake, or you were at you survived the World Trade Center bombing, or the plane attacks of the World Trade Center, or you were at an event. You were at the signing of the Declaration of Independence. You were in an event that would be the precursor to an entire new evolution of technology. That's what it was. I was on the bottom floor of MP3. It happened while I was watching, and I was part of that. I was part of the proliferation of that. Absolutely crazy. So in the way that I tend to do, I try to seek out something that was necessary. Listen, here's the deal. It was great that there was a command line tool. The problem was it costed money. And piracy, of course, was no less of an issue back then than it is now. So people were pirating this thing left and right. But that did not help the average, everyday guy. There were rich people out there that had tons and tons of CDs, but they had no way of making MP3s. There was no way they could bring them to the table. In order to make a market like that work, you've got to create that first turnkey solution that the average guy that's sitting on 9 billion CDs, because he can afford it, to get in on that. I was learning Visual Basic 6 at the time. Actually, no, it wasn't Visual Basic 6. It was something like Visual Basic 4. Whatever it was back in 1999, it was Visual Basic. I created a front end, very similar to the GIF Processor Plus, but specifically for encoding MP3s. It was huge. I charged no money for it. I gave it away for free. It was hoarded around all over the place. And unfortunately, the copy that I had archived on disk so I could always go back and look at it and go, what the hell was I thinking, was corrupted. The CD got a scratch on it, and there was no way to retrieve it. And frankly, if you go out looking for MP3 Producer, which was the name of the product that I made, that name was stolen, reacquired, I should say, by another company. So if you go search for MP3 Producer, you'll find tons of hits, but it's not my MP3 Producer. So that was, I don't remember if I broke unicorn on that one or not. I think at that point in time, DUP was just so, arbitrary at that point that I don't remember actually doing it, but it was huge. In 2000, the DUP curse came around and struck again. Seamus McNally, the guy who left us, who went and did Flying Tigers, or Tiger's Bane as it was called, he passed away from cancer. So that was number two. I decided to re-kickstart the name of Dark Unicorn Productions in 2000. I said, I'm going to get back into gaming. And what really started that was I was using Amos, the creator. It was the language of the gods, if you will. People hated it and people loved it at the same time. And there was no Amos equivalent for the PC. What they did come out with was something called Blitz Basic. And once I got a hold of Blitz Basic and I learned the ins and outs, I decided it was time for me to get back into writing games and bring Dark Unicorn Productions back from the ashes. In 2001, I lost my job. Yeah, I was here in Phoenix. It was at a company called InfoImage, and they went under. And I was unemployed. I was unemployed for over 6 months of 2001. During that time frame, I said, well, listen, I talked to my parents, and I said, listen, I think I can make a game. I think I've got an original idea. I think it's a great game. I think it can make money. And I said, but I can't do it. I can't look for work while I'm trying to make this game. I need to do this full time. And my parents basically said, okay, listen, we're going to front you the money. It's a loan. We're going to give you enough money until you can find serious work or you finish this game and you can get back on your feet. And I borrowed a lot of money from my parents over the course of 2001. But at the end of 2000, towards the middle end of 2001, I created what I would consider still my masterpiece, a game called Versus Ball or VS Ball. And to be quite honest, outside of Your Privacy Assured, this is probably the best thing I've ever written. It's completely original. I didn't swipe it from Blue Angel 69. It's a complete original game. It's an incredibly fun game. It's very well written. I mean, this was professional. I did everything by the book. I commented my code. The code is very clean. I did tons and tons of play testing and tweaking. It's really an amazing product, and it's still a fantastic game. And it sold reasonably well, but there was a very bad time for independent developers at that point in time. It used to be on the Amiga, there just wasn't that many. You could do whatever you wanted, and people It was like the Mac people. They were just dying for food. And you can give them chops, you know, hamburger and call it chop steak, and they were eating it. But in the PC, the competition was very, very fierce. And VS Ball, well, it got very good reviews. The shareware, this was back when, like, Two Cows and everybody was running the shareware market. Everybody gave it great reviews. It had online leaderboards, which was unheard of. You could post your score on the internet. It was really a huge game. It was a great game. And it was financed essentially by my parents. Well, it came and went, and, you know, as indie developers will tell you, you gotta have the next, you know, the next bullet in the chamber right away. You can't just sit on a game unless it's some, you know, some crazy thing like Angry Birds, right? So you have to keep moving. Well, I've always been a huge fan of, Kaboom. You know, the game on the 2600. And I said, you know what? You know what's missing from Kaboom? Frickin' power-ups, man. I thought, you know what would be, if you could have Kaboom with power-ups, that would be the greatest thing ever. So I sat down and started making a game called Kablooey Redux. And it was essentially the futuristic version of Kaboom. And it got... My biggest problem was I gave too much away. There was a very definitive shareware model that you worked with back then. You gave a taste of the game, and then when they left the game or they started the game, you brought up a little screen that said, you know, continue to try or buy now. There was a very specific way to do it, and I did it incorrectly with Kablooey. I gave too much of the game away. And Michael Welch told me, because he was kind of my mentor, he'd been, you know, he did Scorched Tanks, and he was very successful. And he said, you know, you're giving too much of the game away. And it's like, you know, I feel this is a good separation of pay versus free. And I was wrong. So Kablooey Redux, while it was critically acclaimed, and Todd Rogers, who is the world record, he holds more world record on video games than anybody else. Most of you probably already know that. Todd Rogers loves Kablooey. He used to play it like every day, he said. He was huge into Kablooey. He got past levels I never thought was humanly possible. You know, the game was designed to ramp up over time and become faster. And me personally, I could only get like 9 or 10 levels in before I lost it. But there's a reason why he's the world record holder for so many records. And he got to like, you know, 25 or something. It's like, how's that even possible? I didn't even know the game would work that high. So that was pretty cool. It was great. And VS Ball, both Versus Ball and Kablooey Redux, I really went all the way in creating the ultimate Dark Unicorn production intros. At some point, I'm going to videotape these and put them up because, you know, that was sort of the thing was, what can I do? What can I make? How can I better the last thing we did with the Dark Unicorn Productions logo? Well, desperation set in, and, you know, I needed work, right? This wasn't the professional video game writing wasn't working out, and I needed a job. I had a family, I needed a job. So, I got scammed. My ex-boss from InfoImage, Ron Corcoran, he got involved with this guy who was trying to make the ultimate arcade controller. This was back when, you know, it was all the Hanaho stuff was going on, the Hot Rod, the Stick-It, all of these arcade controllers were going on. But what this guy was trying to do was to create a controller that you could change the panels out. You bought the base, and then you could put a trackball or single panel, you know, single player panel, 6-button, 3-button, whatever you could afford, essentially. It was a fairly sound idea, but this guy was a really bad businessman. He hired us to become the software side of the custom arcade. So our job was to create demos, was to create literature and documentation, but more specifically, my job was to create a pack-in game to go with the controller, something custom. I'd always been a big fan of Astro Smash on the Intellivision, and I had written several Falling Rock games is what I call them. I'd written several Falling Rock games. I wrote a manual. I actually got paid to write a manual for a programming language called... wow, I just totally left my head. Anyway, I was hired to... Oh, Div. That's what it was. Div was a DOS-based AMOS-like language, and I was hired to write a beginner's guide for it, which I still have. It's still some of my best work in terms of writing. And I took them from top to bottom and making a Falling Rock kind of game. Well, Ron Corcoran had always loved that, and he's like, you know, dude, can we really take this to the next level? Can we make a really awesome game? So I came up with a concept for a game called Meteor Blaster. And this was about this was the end of 2001, early 2002. And Meteor Blaster was going to be a Dark Unicorn production game, again, to help revive the logo. A pack-in with arcade controllers, this sounded like the way in. Unfortunately, the guy turned out to be an ultimate scam artist. We never got paid. I left a good contracting job that I was, you know, trying to make ends meet with because, I mean, who wouldn't want to write video games, right? I mean, this was my chance to go commercial with this thing. So I started writing Meteor Blaster. And Meteor Blaster, much like VS Ball, or Versus Ball rather, was tight code. And this was written in Blitz Basic. And I'm incredibly proud of it. I used Lightwave, because I had a lot of Lightwave experience on the Amiga, because I had a video toaster. So I got a copy of Lightwave for the PC, and I started rendering planets and three-dimensional rocks and everything, and Meteor Blaster was turning out to be a great game. The concept of Meteor Blaster was that an asteroid of some sort, if I remember right, I'm trying to remember, it's been a while since I looked at it, but essentially the Pluto or Uranus was destroyed, right? And these waves of meteors were coming in, and they were approaching the Earth. Your job was to stop and destroy the meteors before they got there. So you would visit each planet, sort of like Gyrus, right? So you'd start at, I think you started at, what's the outside one? Uranus. So you started on Pluto. And you tried to stop as many rocks as you could, but eventually they overtook you. So you'd move to Jupiter, then to Saturn, then to Mars, right? So you'd move to each one of these. And each one had their own boss character. There were UFOs. But here was the cool part. It was essentially Meteor Blaster, but you had super power weapons. I mean, I came up with some great art. I mean, we had standard stuff, you know, double shot, triple shot, standard arcade fare. But I had this great thing called the Shockwave. And as you were shooting down the meteors, they would break open and sometimes a little white crystal would fall out. And you would harvest these crystals sort of like R-type, and as you were building, as you started getting more and more of these crystals, this little power meter at the bottom was going up. It's a combination of a bunch of different games, okay? But you could use that power up any time. So if you gathered like one crystal, you could use double shot, right? Or shield or triple shot. But if you gathered them up, if you played the greed card, you could eventually get to the point where you get the shockwave or the lasers or all these other cool weapons. So it was really cool. The problem is, of course, is this guy turned out to be a schmuck, and he stiffed us on paying us and all this other stuff. We were going hungry. Everybody was in dire straits. And it turned out the guy was a scam artist. And he said he had financial backing. He had investors, and he didn't really have investors, and blah, 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 blah. So anyway, long story short, Meteor Blaster became sort of one of those tween properties. I didn't really own it. Custom Arcade didn't really own it. Nobody really owned it. So nobody really has permission to do anything with it. They can't touch it. I can't really touch it. So at some point in time, I just said, screw it. You know, there's got to be a statute of limitations on these things. And I started giving it away, what was done of it anyway, on the Retro Gaming Radio DVDs. And some of you who have the later discs know that that's available, and you've probably seen it. But anyway, so that was 2002. And later on, a couple other failed projects. Dino Eggs. Dino Eggs is one of my favorite games on the Commodore 64. And I thought it'd be great to bring it back. It never properly got ported to the PC. And I got a long way with Dino Eggs, man. I mean, down to the point to where really all it really needed to have was a menu put on it. And a way of you know, a smooth transition from level to level, and that was it. The random level generator worked. If you've ever played Dino Eggs, you know what it is. David Schroeder, the guy that wrote it for the Apple II, I got permission from him. He sent me his source code. We worked a big thing. You know, he and I worked a lot on, you know, getting me hooked up and making sure everything was good. It was fantastic, man. I mean, I had rainstorms and all sorts of stuff. It was really cool. Unfortunately, that was another one of those stories that just never got finished. I also started something called Project Trapshoot. This was, Trapshoot was a wall game. Inside a pizza parlor in downtown Wenatchee, there was a wall game called Trapshoot. And essentially, it was a discrete circuit game. It was like a 6-foot by 4-foot game that hung on the wall. You went up and put a quarter in the box, and you took this one button remote control back to your table. And it was a skeet shooting game. And they would light up one of the hunters. There were three hunters on the bottom of the screen. And it was essentially gels. It was a big screen with a whole bunch of colored gels, and then it would turn lights on behind it to show you what was going on. The idea was you were supposed to score trophies by shooting clay pigeons that flew over. I was always like totally delighted by this thing, and I'd never been able to actually find one. I thought about actually buying one. I was that into it. So I said, well, if I can't buy one, I'll make my own. And so I created the shell of what would become Project Trapshoot, which is I did the whole thing. I mean, it was painstaking. I got high-resolution pictures of units with all the lights on. I got somebody to digitize the sound effects that it made. And I really tried to recreate the wall game on a PC. And I got fairly far on it. I mean, I actually got it to where it would actually light the hunters up. And I recreated all the gels. So it really worked just like the arcade version. It was as close to emulation as I could get, but still being simulation. I never got that finished either. I ran into some sort of a glitch or something that stopped me from working on it. And you know, real life gets in the way. The older you get, the more real life gets in the way. What can I tell you? That brings us back up to 2004. I was a huge Opera browser fan, and I still would be if Chrome hadn't come along. And Opera was a little bit behind the times in something called ad blocking. Now, everyone else was blocking ads with, was it Mozilla back then, or was it Firefox by then? I don't remember. But anyway, Opera had a means of doing it by using a blocking filter that was built into the system, but they didn't really call it ad blocking because originally Opera used ads themselves for revenue. So they thought that would be kind of sleazy. But there was a way you could exploit the filter file to make it act like it was an ad blocker. So I created a UI called Opera Ad Filter that would let you easily add and remove things from your block file. And it was relatively useful. Again, Opera was a small community, but a lot of people used it. This led me to move on to something called the host editor. And this was, most of you know about the host file that sits on your Windows box. It's a low level, essentially it can be used as an ad blocker. And I took the Opera ad filter and converted it over to use the hosts file. And it became HostEd, the host file editor. And that was actually remarkably popular. Again, I didn't charge for it. I just let it out for free. And that one you can still find. If you search around Google, you'll be able to find HostEd. HostEd is what it's called. And you can still find that. I dabbled more in programming with under the name Venerable Soft. I created another sort of software company to create flashcards software. And this was back when Nintendo DS had just started getting popular, and flashcards were huge to play game ROMs on. And while I never used it for illegal purposes myself, I own hundreds of DS games. I use the flash card for convenience, but a lot of people, you know, again, this was the case where we had brilliant hardware, the Cyclo DS, and really piss poor software. So I took it upon myself once again to fill a need and created a professional package that you could use along with this fantastic software. But since then, to be honest with you, I've moved towards web development. Everything I make, I kind of do it on the web, and you know, that way everybody can use it. You know, it also became part of my job. I do web development professionally. So it was important for me to continue to hone my craft and expand what I was doing. And anytime a new technology would come out that looked interesting, I would try to apply it to something that I was doing. So that's sort of the end of the story of Dark Unicorn Productions. There were many interesting trials along the way. For a brief time, when Blitz for Basic was huge, or Blitz Basic was huge, rather. You might remember my old producer, Kid Hype Smith, Brian Kid Hype Smith. He was also producing software under the Dark Unicorn name. He liked click and play. That was his poison. He liked click and play, and he made a whole bunch of games using the click and play creation package, and he was also paramount in trying to revive the Dark Unicorn production name. But as you know, as it tends to go, Brian had something with him that was not right. He had an intestinal issue. And most of you who are old listeners of the show remember this very, very well. Brian was my best friend. He was my producer. He brought Retro Gaming Radio back when I didn't think I was interested in doing Retro Gaming Radio anymore. He showed me that there was still a market. There were still people that wanted it and loved it. And he passed away as well. And so that was the third one, right? They come in threes. And sure enough, we had three people in the illustrious Dark Unicorn Productions history that are no longer with us today. So the power of three, I guess, right? Anyway, that's pretty much where DUP ends. I'd love someday. I've thought about if I was going to write games again, it would probably be on the Android platform. I'm waiting for a good library to come around. And who's got time, right? Who's got time to do that anymore? I'm 43 years old. I've got this show to put out. I've got tons of other endeavors. Who's got time to write software? But I do still try to, I do a lot of programming still. It just doesn't hinge under the DUP moniker. Well, I hope you enjoyed that look at Dark Unicorn Productions. We'll be back with more mainstream stuff next month. But this was something I felt was necessary. And I think, I'm hoping it was entertaining. I hope you enjoyed it. Like I said, we did gain a certain amount of fame. You know, Scorch Tanks and Tomcat really made a difference. In fact, I was over in Europe in the Navy. This was probably, oh, I don't know, 93-ish, 94-ish. It would have had to have been after, let me check a look at my timeline here. It would have had to have been after Scorched Tanks was out for a while. So I think it was like 94. It was like a year before I got out. I was in port, in a foreign port, and one of the other, the Navy from the country that we were in, I can't remember for the life of me where it was, he came in and I was on watch, so I was just sitting, I mean, I was on duty that day, so I couldn't go out, and he came down to the boat to work on something or get a tour, and the Europeans, man, sorry, little late nights, the Europeans really loved the Amiga, right? So the Amiga was a lot more popular over there. Like I said, David Hasselhoff of computing, right? So we got talking, and I said, yeah, you know, I write software for the Amiga. Oh, yeah, well, you know, anything I might know? And I told him about Dark Unicorn. He's like, dude, I love your stuff, man. And he started gushing, and it was kind of the first time that I'd ever really had any sort of real fame, you know. I mean, here's this guy from another country, never saw the guy in my life, and out of nowhere, he's like, oh, I love your stuff. So he played Psycho Squares, he played Scorched Tanks, he played Tomcat. He was not a full-motion video guy. I remember that. He was not real thrilled with that, but he liked what the rest of us were doing. So we covered all the bases, I guess, if you will. So, gang, that's going to wrap it up for the anniversary look at Dark Unicorn Productions. We'll be back next month with yet another blast from the historical past with another anniversary. And you stick around. We got more show to come. Well, this month's Bits and Bytes is absolutely packed full of great retro goodness. We're going to get started right away. First up, Hugh Johnson wrote a very nice letter stating how much he enjoyed Retro Gaming Radio in the past, and when Retro Gaming Radio left the airwaves, he and his compadres comprised a little show called The Retro League. Now, The Retro League is another podcast. They've been putting out... they have a lot of episodes. They're up to episode 150, you know, and you know how I feel about this stuff, right? I'm a firm believer that you cannot have enough retro gaming goodness, whether it be podcasts or websites or magazines or documentation, whatever it is. I'm a firm believer that we need more as much as possible. And these guys have a very clean, nicely put together page. And let's see, what is, let me take a look at, I'll give you some flow through here on this episode. Everything old is new again. They're wrapping up a launch title series by looking at the start of the virtual console on the Wii. Talk about classics that were re-released in the year, the long gone year of 2006. Let's see. Topics, do you dream about retro gaming? Your thoughts on randomly generated game content? They look at a couple of items here. Final Fantasy III for the PSP, Grand Theft Auto III for PS2 Classics. So it looks like they have a nice, well-rounded podcast dealing with the same kind of stuff that we do. And in fact, he said that they created this sort of as a, you know, they were sad that we left and that other shows had come and gone and that they thought maybe they'd take a crack at it. So this is it, and the Retro League is what you're looking for. Thanks again to Hugh Johnson for sending that in for us. Next up, let's see, Vince Dickinson, regular contributor to the show, let us know that it's officially the 40th anniversary of video games. As of now, in August 28th, 1972, the original Magnavox came out, the original Odyssey came out by Magnavox, and it was, of course, the very first game console, right? That's insane. 1972. Can you believe it? That's 3 years, almost to the day after I was born. Some of you weren't even an itch in your daddy's pants at that point. But here's an article that talks about this 40th anniversary, about the Magnavox Odyssey. It's odd because, you know, I never knew anybody that had one of those. You know, one of the earliest video game consoles I personally remember is the Fairchild Channel F. And this predates that by some time. In this link, it also gives you a video, a commercial from February 1973 about the Odyssey from Magnavox. So anyway, actually a couple different commercials. So check this out. This is... It's old stuff. It's amazing. I mean, this is really is the origins, right? This is the beginning of the beginning. And Ralph Baer was, you know, the guy that started all this. We tend to hear Nolan Bushnell. We tend to hear David Crane. We tend to hear less about Ralph Baer, and the guy deserves simply metric buttloads of credit for his contribution to our hobby. Next up, let's see... Ah, yes, Gary Adamson, another great guy that contributes to Retro Gaming Radio all the time, sends in this link, The History of the Floppy Disk. Now, I've been there almost since the beginning. I started off with tape drives, right? The TRS-80 Model 3 that I used had a tape drive. My VIC-20, Commodore VIC-20, and my C64 all had cassette drives. But somewhere in the really real world, in the big world, there was an 8-inch floppy disk. And it's really funny. Here's a good side note, a good side story. Some of you may remember this. A few years back, I was at a flea market, and somebody was selling boxes of 8-inch floppy disks. I mean, these things are huge. Nobody I know personally ever had to use an 8-inch floppy. If you were a big fan of war games, you saw him putting an 8-inch floppy into one of his drives. So that's how far back that goes. But I used a lot of, you know, 5 1/4-inch floppies, and of course 3 1/2-inch quote floppies. Even though they were in a rigid case, they were still floppy inside. And this gives you a pretty good overview. It even tells you about the old punch card days, and it shows you how these poor guys... These poor guys had to write code using punch cards. So I'll take whatever floppy I can get my paws on. But this is cool. It shows you different types of drives and the breakdown of what they look like. It's an interesting little article. Definitely worth your time if you're into historical looks at our old hardware. A bunch of people sent this one in, and I'm not sure really how to take this. Essentially... In my earlier on in the show, if you listen to the editorial commentary, I said, what are we chasing? What's the technology we're chasing? we've sort of lost our way when it comes to chasing tech, because we don't chase tech anymore. And so in the article previously, I talked about that we're not, what's left to go? We have holograms. That's the next big thing. Well, they're trying to actually, Microsoft is trying to put together a means of playing a game on every wall in your home. And so they have this demo of Ms. Pac-Man on your, on all of your walls and on your ceiling. And that's how the game is spread out. Now, I seem to remember doing something similar to this when we first got a projector at work. We could actually take a game and project it on the wall and even push it up against on the ceiling if we want to. But it's the same sort of idea. They're trying to find the next big tech wave to ride. We've done motion control. We've done the Kinect, you know, motion detection. We've done all this. What's next? What do we do next? And this is supposedly what Microsoft is banking their future on. Not sure I buy into it, but interesting all the same, right? Especially the fact that they used Ms. Pac-Man as the woman of choice, so to speak, for showing off this technology. That's pretty cool. Let's see. So from me, I ran across this fun article about 13 classic video games and how they got their name. Now, a lot of this stuff is old lore that most of us already know. Most people do know that Pac-Man started off as Puckman. P-U-C-K. Well, a simple alteration of the marquee, a marker here, a switchblade there, and then you have a four-letter word that ends in man that probably wouldn't be great in the arcade. So they chose to rename it to Pac-Man instead of Puckman. That's one of those things that we all know about, right? So let me see, what else is on this list? Metroid comes from, you know, Metroid. Metroid comes from a combination of Metro and Android. See? Learn something new every day. Let's see. Tetris was named after a geometric shape in a sport. As you probably already know, he combined two words, tetramino and tennis. That's how Tetris got its name. Grand Theft Auto was going to be called Race and Chase. I think they chose the better name. Wolfenstein 3D took on its name after another software company lost its copyright. A lot of people know about that. There's whole articles on this stuff. This isn't just quick stuff. Doom got its name from a scene in The Color of Money. Guerrilla War was known by another name in the other parts of the world. Legend of Zelda was named after F. Scott Fitzgerald's wife, which a lot of people, I think, know as well. Final Fantasy was a game developer's last shot in the video game industry. Yar's Revenge is Atari's then CEO name spelled backwards. A lot of people remember that. Qbert was inspired by M.C. Escher's drawings. Some people already knew that. Halo had some strange potential names until the creators named it after the shape of the planet Solipsis. I don't even know what that means. And, of course, Donkey Kong, you know, the monkey. Donkey Monkey fiasco, that's all in there as well. So there you go. We have a whole bunch of good stuff there if you want to do some more research on that. Also from yours truly, a retrospective on the company Rare. Now, Rare seems to be a company, you love them or you hate them. Some people do have some mixed feelings about it. Well, I hated this, but I liked that. But most people seem to feel one way or the other. I did not get an opportunity to watch this whole retrospective. I'm not a Rare fan personally. However, I know tons of my listeners are, so I wanted to share that video with you. Now, this is pretty good. We are in the age where there a lot of people don't know this, but as a developer, I can tell you. I do this for a living. There is a mad fat push for what's going to control the web for technology. Now, right now, you've got all sorts of competing technology, right? You got Flash, you got Silverlight, you've got Shockwave, you know, which is technically Flash. You've got HTML5, and you've got like different aspects of HTML5. And, you know, now Microsoft is trying to get rid of JavaScript and come up with their own thing. Again, you'd think they would have learned enough the first time. but in any event, everybody keeps changing their mind. As soon as somebody tries to corner the market with some of their own proprietary technology, like Silverlight Microsoft, and it doesn't work out, they go back to what everybody decided they wanted to use, which was HTML5. So now that Microsoft is backing that, and now that their browser actually doesn't totally suck, they got in cahoots with Atari, and they have created a pure browser, HTML5 Atari Arcade. And this is tons and tons of games, not just classic games, but classic games revisited, new ways to play the old games, and all of this is done on HTML5. No plugins for your browser, no third-party technologies, it just plays in the browser. And of course, they want you to use Internet Explorer, because these games have been reimagined by Internet Explorer. Well, welcome to the party, pal. You're a little bit late to the HTML5 party. But in any event, let's not look a gift horse in the mouth. If you're willing to use IE10, they'll strip the ads out of this site so that you can play this stuff without ads. Otherwise, you get disturbed by advertising if you're using any other browser. But it has games like Missile Command and Pong and Super Breakout, Yar's Revenge, Asteroid, Centipede, Combat, Lunar Lander, you know. So there's a whole bunch of stuff you can play, and it's all for free if you're willing to sit through the ads or use Internet Explorer. So it's always kind of nice to see, and it's, again, the presentation of it's really slick. They got stacks of cartridges that move as you scroll your mouse wheel, blah, blah, blah. So pretty cool. That was actually sent in by a variety of different people. So, you know, I won't give any specific credit on that one. Let's see. Chris Hull, who's our... he's our mod expert. Anytime some cool mod or somebody puts together a coffee table and turns into Space Invaders, he's right there and he knows about it. He sent us over a link from ThinkGeek, which has, of course, tons of cool stuff. This is a power-up light switch. And essentially what this is, it looks like a little arcade cabinet, control panel, rather. It's got a couple of buttons and a joystick on it. You take your light cover off in your house, in your room, and you replace it with this, and you use the joystick to turn the light on and off, and it plays classic arcade sounds, blah, blah, blah. Pretty cool. $30, maybe not for everybody, but it definitely looks cool. I mean, geeks would just eat this up. So if you're looking for... Here's what this is. Let me explain to you what this is. This is the gift that you give the guy that has everything. First of all, people wouldn't buy this for themselves because it's on the edge of that, you know, it's not $20, which anybody could put out, but $30, I'm not going to get one, right? And it's something that nobody would ever get from themselves because they don't want to get laughed at. But if you get it as a gift, that's okay. So if you are listening to the show and you're one of those casual retro gamers and you've got one of those diehard gaming geek freaks on your Christmas list this year, this is a perfect, trust me, a perfect gift for that person that buys themselves everything that you can never find what they want. Pretty cool. Again, Chris Hull sends in, remember I said about turning a coffee table into Space Invaders? Well, this is a mod, a do-it-yourself mod, turning a coffee table into an awesome two-player arcade cabinet. It's very cool. It's got like slide in and out drawers for the control panel, little speakers built onto it. It's very cool, and, you know, I'd love to have something like this, but, you know, I have no technical aptitude, so I'm certainly never going to be able to build one of these myself, but this guy took, like, you know, over-the-counter IKEA stuff and built this cabinet out of it, which is absolutely fantastic. It's got Pac-Man in the picture. This was on Lifehacker, of all places, which is even more weird to see stuff like that. Vince Dickinson shows up again with the 10 worst products from the pages of Electronic Games magazine from 1982 to 1983. So let's take a look at some of these, and I'm not going to go through all of them, but one of them is an Asteroids Halloween costume, and they have a picture of this. Wow, that sucks. Here's a really bad hat. Let's see. A video game glove, the Bat Mitt. Wow. here's something called the Stick Station. It's a solid piece of hard wood that you put and mount your Atari 2600 controller into. Actually, that's kind of smart. Here's something called the Grandstand. It's a podium for your Atari 2600 joystick. This was probably the inspiration for the Kid Icarus stand for the Nintendo 3DS. It's perfect. Build your own family arcade enclosure, video game cartridges for free. What's the deal on that one? Oh, with membership, of course, membership. And this just goes on and on. There's all sorts of great stuff, but I mean, I love when you pull apart old magazines and you see these ads for stuff you just can't possibly believe anybody would buy. Vince also dug up for us an interview, and I haven't had a chance to watch this. My schedule's been so packed. This is an interview with Jack Tramiel, Jack Tramiel of Commodore. This was in 1985. Right, so it's about 30 minutes long, and I would actually love to get a chance to watch it. At some point I will, but yeah, that's going to go on my bookmark so I can get to it another time. But yeah, you know, the guy was a genius, all right? The guy knew how to make things work. And if you haven't heard, a couple episodes back we did the full story of when Jack Tramiel, it's a hard habit to break. Jack Tramiel passed away, and we did a full retrospective of his life, and we talked all about it. So it's very cool to be able to dig up this sort of archive of this videos and interviews. This stuff doesn't last forever, you know. A lot of people don't keep this stuff around. Thank God for the Computer Chronicles, right? Good stuff indeed. Good stuff indeed. All right, what do we have up next here? Sorry, I'm kind of blowing through these. We've got so much to look at. Next up, we have Alex J. Lopez sends us in Living in Pitfall's Shadow. And I can definitely understand this. Game designer and former Activision co-founder David Crane has shipped more video games than just about anybody, over 100, since his first game in 1977. And yet there's only one title he's generally remembered for, and that's Pitfall, the jungle-themed Atari 2600 adventure that defined what we now call the platform genre. And it's true. I mean, this guy's done tons of stuff like Ghostbusters on the Commodore 64, A Boy and His Blob. He spent a ton of time at GameWorks creating that, the sponsor-based branded video gaming. And but this is it. You know, it's got to be like, you know, William Shatner or any of these other guys that kind of get pigeonholed into a motif or a style or a product or a role. And you just can't get away from it. And, I mean, I guess that's something to be called, you know, an advantage for infamy, but I don't know. He's recently tried to get a Kickstarter put together to recreate Pitfall, go back to the jungle, using 2D type gaming, but using lush 3D graphics. And unfortunately for them, they were not able to get that money together. They were seeking nearly $1 million, $900,000, and they got somewhere around $25,000. I put my money down. But, you know, Kickstarters don't always work, and Crane's a brilliant guy, you know, so who knows what he's got on the shelf. But it is kind of sad, though, that you get pigeonholed for certain things. Yeah, I feel for him. Again, Chris Hull brings us another oddity. Here is Bomb Jack as implemented on FPGA. So people love to port software over to these low-level pieces of hardware, and there's always these great... I don't understand the draw to it. I'll have to get Jerry in here so she can explain to me what the draw is to building hardware that should, I mean, you've got the accessibility to run whatever you want, but you gotta get Bomb Jack running on this, you know? But hey, you know what? Like I said, more power to anybody that wants to do this stuff. I want to see Bomb Jack put Joust, make Joust run on a camera. I'm good to go. Whatever you want to do, just keep video gaming and classic video gaming alive. There's this thing called Ken's Log. I have no idea what it is. I've never seen it. But this Ken's Log, apparently, from what I understand, is a father-son team that got together and they shot videos for YouTube. They had hundreds of them, where they would look at some movie or they'd look at some video game. They apparently did a lot of video gaming. And this was real important. It was a father-son thing. You know, parents, you guys understand that. And they had a really good time doing it. A freak accident happened, and this is where we're going to give you a link to the video. Some freak accident happened, burned their house to the ground, took all of their stuff with them, and the son lost his life in the fire. I mean, how unbelievably crazy is that? That comes from Retro G News. That's just that's incredible. I mean, I can't even imagine, you know. I had my kid run away from home, right? That was the big thing on Passenger Seat Radio. That impacted me a lot. And I immediately got on the air the next day and told the story, right? That's sort of the way I run my Passenger Seat Radio show. It's sort of an inside look to my life. And these guys were no different, you know. The day after this tragedy happened, this guy got on there and said, you know, here's what happened. And it's unbelievable. So check that out. Give the guys some support. I mean, I don't even know what you say in a situation like that, but I don't know. That's just, I don't even know what else to say about that. Here's an interesting article from Eurogamer. This was submitted, I think, by me. Yeah. This is an article about whether gaming, retro gaming is actually better, or if it's just the nostalgia that makes it great. What is it that gives us desire to experience these old games? What's the purpose behind it? Where's the social correlation? Where's the mental correlation? And I think it hits some interesting points. You know, I also believe that in addition to some of the points that this makes as well, that I think there was it was a better era, not because, just because we were allowed to be, not only allowed to be creative, you know, marketing wasn't dictating what to write, but David Crane would lock himself in the closet, and in 6 months he'd come out with a top number one selling game. You don't have that anymore. I think that having limited, being forced to work in a very constrained environment required people to work harder and make things better. You couldn't just ship a service pack. You couldn't just do this. You couldn't just do that to get by, to get through these things. You actually had to write solid code the first time through. So I think that has a lot to do with it. But it's a good article. I totally recommend reading it. It's very interesting, at least from a psychological perspective. Here we have the purest form. This is, let's see, who sent this one in? Alex J. Lopez sent this in. This is the Atari 2600 joystick in its purest form, which is all white. And it's kind of cool. They have Rubik's Cubes and Nintendo controllers, all this other stuff, and it's all pure white. You know, there's no color. It's devoid of any kind of markings or marketing branding. It's just the pureness of it. The part that always cracked me up about this when I saw it, which is probably why I wanted to talk about it, was it reminds me, if you look at these, if you were a fan of the original Battlestar Galactica from the 70s, there was a race of godlike beings that were chasing down an evil devil played by Patrick McNee. And at one point in time, some of the main characters were killed in the show. And these entities brought them back to life. And in the room, this room, everything was pure white. The Colonial Warrior outfits were all white. The guns were white. It was basically the same thing. This is the Battlestar Galactica white stuff. It's fascinating. I love it. So that gave me a good chuckle, if nothing else, just remembering that. Nicholas also sends in, he's one of our regular contributors as well. He sent in a Double Dragon Neon review. Double Dragon was once again remade as Double Dragon Neon, and now I haven't played this thing. Okay, it came out in September, And supposedly what this is it's exactly what I always talk about. The same game with better graphics and better sound. And IGN just tore it apart. At some point I'm going to have to probably break down and play it. But it's worth looking at just to see what their guys were thinking. So, hey, was Double Dragon perfect? Absolutely not. But, you know, I like to support people that are doing exactly what I tell them to do, right? Andrew Driver, another contributor, sends in a Midway Origins trailer. This is yet another Midway attempt to cash in on their classic products. It's another retro collection. This is going to be only on next-gen consoles, as from what I've seen. And it's only going to be on Xbox and PlayStation 3, which means if you're going Wii U this generation, which I plan to, then you're going to be out of luck. But the trailer doesn't really offer anything in the way of games. It offers a lot of rendered flash and panache. It's a sizzle reel, if you will. But, you know, it's worth me sending out for you guys to take a look at. Let's see. What's up next? Oh, so most of you know, this came from Gary Adamson. Most of you know I am not familiar with a lot of the European classic computers, like the Spectrum. Apparently, the Spectrum was not the only game in town. There apparently was a knockoff. Now, this just blows me away. Somebody knocked off the Spectrum and called it the Jupiter Ace. And this little guy is turning 30 years old as well. And this has a complete write-up and talks more about this interesting little machine. I think it's funny because, you know, the Spectrum, it came here, right? I think we had it here, but, like, nobody got it. I don't know. I'm very confused. But this Jupiter Ace gets to celebrate its birthday as well, and we definitely want to encourage that. Let's see what's next up. Chris Hull again sends us in a modified NES Zapper gets turned into a laser gun. And it's a, let's see, it can set things on fire, blah, blah, blah. Just watch the video. Just watch the video. That's all I can tell you. And see how they turned a zapper into an actual laser gun. Don't try this at home, kids. Don't try this at home. Let's see. Next up, Scott Julian sends in a recommendation for a book called Priming the Pump, How TRS-80 Enthusiasts Helped Spark the PC Revolution. I'm probably going to pick this book up. It's available on Kindle for $10, so I might pick that up and read it. Again, remember, I started my very first computer that I used was a TRS-80 Model 3, and I think it'd be interesting to check that out. Let's see, personal computers grew out of the hobbyist movement in the 70s, building their own computers, blah, blah, blah. See if there's anything really great to read in the description, but check it out. You can look inside, of course, on Amazon site and see if the content interests you. I'm definitely interested in it. I got a whole bunch of books I'd like to look at on old computer stuff. Alex sent this in, and the guy didn't tell me about it, which is funny because I would have probably spent forever on here. This is called We Are Back, and these guys have taken, remember we talked about HTML5 earlier? These guys are taking classic Amiga demos and the classic Amiga or the Mega Demo concept. Those of you from the old school days, you know what I'm talking about. They took that and they are making 100% HTML5 demos that run in your browser, mega demos with the cool sine wave text and the copper scroll bars and the whole bit. That's what they're doing, and they're doing it all using straight up browser technology. Just freaking killer. I mean, I love some of this stuff. Some of the old Cortex stuff is here. I don't know, just go check it out. You know right now whether or not you're interested in it or not. If you really loved the Mega Demo disc that went out not too long ago, if you're just an old fan of Mega Demos, you just got to go check it out. They recommend you view it in Chrome because HTML5, according to the hackers here, the developers of this, HTML5 is 3 times faster performance-wise under Chrome than in Firefox. I know a lot of my listeners are Firefox fans, but you might want to visit this in Chrome. Let's see. the legend of Chrono Trigger. Myself and former producer, best friend of mine, passed away quite a while back, We did a mockumentary, if you will, on Chrono Trigger, and it became one of the most and the least appreciated segments that we ever did. And so constantly Chrono Trigger is always sent to me. There's something about Chrono Trigger that gets sent. This is somebody sent this. Let's see, who sent this one in? This was Nicholas again. He sends in Chrono Trigger in 5 minutes. Somebody cut Chrono Trigger and turned into a 5-minute video. Yeah. I mean, again, I never played it all the way through, so I probably can't appreciate it, but I know so many of my listeners are Chrono Trigger fans. You want to check it out. Another thing from Nicholas, the pinball has really been making a comeback. There are huge development efforts, the pinball arcade, Zen Pinball, Pinball Effects. There are tons of new tables. New tables come out every year, real physical tables. So there's still a huge retro push for pinball. And so somebody came up with, and I am not a BioShock fan, but somebody created a BioShock pinball machine. Now, I can't appreciate this at all. I don't understand what Big Daddy is. I don't understand what Rapture is. But apparently, this is really cool for the people who do. And it's pinball, so I can't argue with that. Nicholas also sends in horrible design candidates for the Super Nintendo. So this article is all about what the Super Nintendo could have looked like based on early prototype drawings. I didn't think it was that attractive of a system with the final design they came up with, but those are even worse. And finally, we have here in our midst the Pitfall Postmortem, the making of a 2600 Classic. And this is, I believe, if I remember right, it's an hour-long video of David Crane answering questions and talking about everything. Everything about creating Pitfall, everything that he's done. And this was all done at the Game Developers Conference back in 2011. So, you know, I watched like 10 minutes of it. This is pretty much the definitive David Crane video from the looks of it. PowerPoint presentation, talks about all sorts of cool stuff. So I would definitely check this out. Put it on your list. It's an hour long, so, you know, you got to consume it as the best you can. But hey, still pretty cool, right? And last up on the list is, and I don't have my credit here for this. Oh, here it is. This I should have known. Nicholas sent this in as well. Somebody took a 2600, the Worship the Wood Grain edition of the 2600, gutted it, and turned it into a PC. So, again, people will turn anything into anything else if given enough time. And enough free time anyway, I should say. So yet another interesting hack put together by our community. So turning old stuff into new stuff. Sort of what Commodore's been doing for the last 10 years, or whoever it is that owns the Commodore name these days. Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up for Bits and Bytes. Remember, Bits and Bytes, of course, is created much by you, the listeners, sending us news and information, things you'd like us to discuss. Send it over to bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com or bitsbytes@retrogamingradio.com works as well. Feel free to send us anything that you see over the next month that looks interesting, and you may have your story read right here on the air. So keep us loaded up with Bits and Bytes stuff, folks. You guys have been doing a great job so far. We've had a full year of constantly getting in new stuff, and I do appreciate it. So join us next month. We'll have another giant Bits and Bytes right here on Retro Gaming Radio. This month we have one review, and that is on the Activision Anthology. The Activision Anthology is available for iOS and Android. And depending on which platform you get it on, apparently you're going to have some different experiences. We're going to talk about that in a minute. So what is Activision Anthology? It is a free download, of course, that gives you access to 45 Activision and Imagic titles on your portable device. It comes with Kaboom for free, and you can buy the games in different packs, but essentially $7 will unlock the whole thing. Now, I know what you're thinking. $7, 45 games, Activision and a Magic, the two biggest names on the 2600, this seems like a complete no-brainer. Unfortunately, as per always, they always ruin these things with something. And we're going to talk about that more in a few minutes as well. Let's start off with what it is. It's a very slick UI. They really put some time, thought, and effort into creating a very cool environment for you to look at games, select games, and play games. Okay, let's start off with the titles, right? Everyone wants to know what's on the... in the package. Well, here we go. Here's 45 titles. This can't be all 45 here. There's a lot, though. I'll read them off. Atlantis, Barnstorming, Beam Rider, Boxing, Bridge, Checkers, Chopper Command, Cosmic Commuter, Crackpots, Decathlon, Demon Attack, Dolphin, Dragonfire, Dragster, Enduro, Fishing Derby, Freeway, Frostbite, Grand Prix, Hero, Ice Hockey, Kabobber, Kaboom, Keystone Capers, Laser Blast, Mega Mania, Moonsweeper, Oink, Pitfall, Pitfall 2, Plaque Attack, Pressure Cooker, Private Eye, River Raid, River Raid 2, Robot Tank, Sequest, Skiing, Skyjinx, Sky Shuttle, or I'm sorry, Space Shuttle, Spider Fighter, Stampede, Star Master Tennis, and Thwacker. So that's the list you get for $7. Now, let's be honest, there's some really top-name titles in here, right? Huge fan favorites, Demon Attack, Atlantis, Kaboom, Dragonfire, Chopper Command, Megalomania, Keystone Capers. There's absolutely tons of top-notch titles in this collection. Unfortunately, we're down to the same scenario we are with anything else. How do you play the games? Right? You've got a cell phone, you've got a tablet, you have no physical controls. How do you play the games? Well, if you have iOS, if you're running an Apple device and you happen to have the very cool iCade, apparently it has iCade support out of the box, which would definitely turn this into a better package out of the box. However, according to the Android description, it also supports Android gamepads, which when I checked the title, it did not work with Android gamepads. So who knows if it actually works with iCade. iOS has access to Game Center for posting your scores and achievements, and Android uses Facebook. How unfortunate, even though the description says it uses Google Play to handle leaderboards. Certain games do have two-player support, like boxing. And there are a very collection of control pads. Now, I'm going to give the boys credit. What they tried to do is they took a couple of the more common control methods, like follow my finger, virtual D-pad. There's like four or five different ones, tilt, four or five different controls, and they pick a subset of those controls for each game that would be the most beneficial for that title. So in some cases, the D-pad is going to be your best bet. In other cases, you might want to use tilt controls. So they went the extra mile to give you an option, a myriad of options for controls. Unfortunately, none of them are very good. And several of them even lag inside the game. Not good. Not good. But you would think at least that they would support basic D-pad entry, Xperia Play, right? For the Xperia control-enabled devices on Android. It was just such a missed attempt, and they could fix this any time with an update. However, they have not, and this has been out for quite a while. They have a very slick UI, and when you actually... I'll just give you kind of a painted picture. It looks like sort of a living room, and a desk with a TV or a monitor on it, and you slide your finger across the side to scroll through cartridges of all the different games that are supported. Once you stop on one, it's kind of like spinning the big wheel on the Price is Right. Once you stop on one, the little TV updates and a little animated video or animated screen shows up on the little monitor. So it's really cool. Then you can actually click on the game and select to look closer at it, and it'll give you a three-dimensional box 3D box that the cartridge came in the old days. You can grab it, rotate it, spin it, zoom it, and then click open, and it'll actually pull the cartridge out of the box and let you look at that. You can also access scans of the original manuals and some other little goodies like that. Very impressive, right? Very slick. However, what you're not going to find in here are things like videos, right? You would think that we would have more Activision historical documentation, but there's really nothing else in here. So what's the bottom line? Well, as everybody knows, when it comes to packages like this, there's two things that are key. Controls, which we've just talked about, are not very good. Again, it's like they did everything they could, but in the end, there's only one way to play these games, and that's with physical controls. And unless you're on iOS, and maybe not even then, physical controls are not part of the equation. And that is just insane. I mean, they even let you move the on-screen D-pad and buttons around on the screen and shrink and scale them to fit whatever size tablet or phone you want, but it's still not enough. It's not enough. And of course, the second part of any of these packages are, how's the emulation, right? Now, it's done by Code Mystics, and Code Mystics usually does a really good job with emulation. Something went wrong, and at least on the Android version, I cannot speak of the Apple version. On the Android version, on both my Tegra 3 device, my Galaxy Nexus 7, and my Galaxy Nexus phone, which I think is what, Snapdragon processor, right? On either one of these devices, we have trouble with sound. I mentioned some of the control lag. There are ways of finessing the controls, apparently, somebody said. I haven't actually found it, but one of the readers posted that. But sound is not right on many, many titles. Mega Mania is a huge... You can play Mega Mania and go, what is wrong with this? There's something wrong. And it has to be something wrong with the emulation. Because I can literally move Activision Anthology to the background and bring up 2600.mu from Robert Broglia and play Mega Mania, and it plays exactly the way I remember it. So there's something hokey going on in the emulation. Again, it can be fixed with a patch. Fix the sound emulation. Give us built-in gamepad controls on Android. And I think we would have a great system. Oh, by the way, lose the dependency on Facebook, okay? Because one of the other great things that they added is patch support. Remember in the old days, you could get patches. You could send in like screenshots or forms and get patches from Activision. These are back. It's sort of like the first achievements, you know, before Xbox came up with them, or trophies or whatever. And it has patch support, but again, you're tied to Facebook. And if you don't want to use Facebook, you're out of luck. So, could this be, is it worth $7, right? That's the first question. Is it worth $7? If you can put up with virtual controls, or you're willing to do a lot of working out with USB Bluetooth controller, joystick center, and mapping your own on-screen controls for your device and all that stuff, I would say that just the sheer number of titles and the sheer insane amount of quality titles that this package has is probably worth your $7, right? 45 games, $7, great interface. And a lot of people aren't even going to notice the emulation issues. But listen, I figure if you're really into the 2600 and you're willing to play, you know, you're willing to pay to play old Activision and Imagine games, you're probably going to have a very firm memory of how these games sounded and how they played. And if they don't match that expectation, you're going to be disappointed. So, this could be a great program. If it gets an updated patch, if they fix the sound emulation, if they give us gamepad controls, if any of these things happen, this product becomes even more and more valuable. Right now, I cannot give my seal of approval on it. I am very tough on emulation, and this is not good enough for Retro Gaming Radio's seal of approval. For now, if you really want to play 2600 on your Android device, at least, and I can't speak for the iOS folks, but I would recommend purchasing the 2600.emu from Robert Brolia. I think it's like $3, and use your own ROM sets. This has built-in support for the Wii controller, right? So if you have a Wii controller sitting around the house, you can immediately sync it right to your phone, right to your tablet, and you'll be playing real 2600 games with real controls and not have any of these sort of issues that this Activision anthology has. So there you have it, folks, our review for this month. Join us next month. We'll have even more reviews right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next month with another great episode of Retro Gaming Radio. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at Retro Gaming Radio, take away the O at the end. And, of course, at Google Plus, we have a page there. And, of course, www.retrogamingradio.com. You can follow us there as well. Oh, don't forget, Alex J. Lopez has been keeping the Shoutcast server up and running with 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week classic Retro Gaming Radio content at your favorite Shoutcast server. You can also go to shoutcast.com, search for Retro Gaming Radio, and of course use your favorite Shoutcast app on your cell phone or mobile device, and you can listen to us anytime you feel like it. Thanks to Alex J. Lopez for running that huge burden. He does it because you guys love it. Anyway, folks, that's going to do it for this edition of Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe saying, until next time, keep it retro.